tell you a joke, which philosophy does not have much of, but it has one at least, I know. Yesterday I talked a lot about Robert Grosseteste in Oxford, and he is considered by many historians, most historians of this period, as the true founder of the tradition of scientific thought, and perhaps even the founder of the English intellectual tradition. He's a very important man. And it was he who first tried assimilating observation from experiment with the rational explanations and the mathematics that was being developed, but with the rational explanations from the 12th century. His theory of experimental science created three categories. They are inductive, experimental, and mathematical. And these remain the basis of scientific investigations to this very day. Aristotle taught him that induction was necessary to discover the cause when you can see the effects. This is not easy. Observed knowledge, according to Aristotle, involves complicated composite objects that we see through our senses. And every time these people mention senses, they're really talking not about things you necessarily see and hear, but about things you can test and measure and so forth. So it's a much more complicated thing. But the process of induction is the breaking up of these composites into the fundamental principles or elements, the achieving of the looking for the abstract principles which lay behind observations. And I mentioned today, this could be even described as educated guesswork. It is Grosseteste who really developed the philosophy of nominalism, which is the basis of most of today's philosophy. And I'll talk about nominalism, but I'll give you an example if I can first. And this sounds terribly like Darwinian evolution, because he says, why do some animals have horns? And he looks at this and he says, well, some animals don't have teeth in their upper jaw. I didn't know that, actually, so I've learned something. Ruminants, animals who eat grass, don't have teeth in their upper jaw. They have bony plates in their upper jaw, and so they can't bite, and so they can't defend themselves, and so they have horns, or they're very fast, or they're big like camels. That's very Darwinian, I thought. Also, the lack of their ability to chew vegetable matter means that digestion is not good, and so they have more than one stomach to aid their digestion. He is also the first person to really write down carefully that we can never reach a final cause or absolutely certain knowledge of a cause or form from its effect. Unlike mathematics, where we can be dead certain, boy, back in school, when I could do a proof in geometry and I wrote QED at the bottom, I knew it was right. And that's not true in science. That's not true in nature. You can never be absolutely sure, despite the fact that since we human beings don't change very fast, people continue to ask that if somebody grows GM crops, can I be absolutely certain that they will not hurt me? Or can I be absolutely certain that meteorites will not strike the earth? Or can I be absolutely certain that if the NSA listens into all my telephone conversations, there will never again be a terrorist attack on me? The answer to that is entirely no. You can't be absolutely certain. Science doesn't work like that. Nature doesn't work like that. But it is also from Grosseteste that we have this concept of the uniformity of nature, that the same cause will always cause the same effects. This has got the fancier name of determinism. And in the 20th century, quantum mechanics has shown that it's not true. So you just never know. As many of Aristotle's ideas became subject to observation, it became increasingly clear that they were nonsense and they just didn't, embarrassingly wrong. Now, we'll divide medieval philosophers into three camps as they learn more about Aristotle. And this comes from his ideas of categories, which I talked about before. These are differences about a discussion of whether universal things or ideas can exist in themselves or only in our minds, whether things are corporeal or incorporeal, whether they're separated from sensible objects or they are contained within sensible objects. So the first of these camps are called the realists. Now, to show you how language changes in 800 years since 1300, 700 years since 1300, it's not 2100 yet, the word realism in those days has an almost entirely opposite meaning to what realism means today. So please don't get confused. But they're called the realists. And they believe that the only substantial reality is in universal things. The opposite of them are the nominalists, and nominalists believe that the universals are names we give to things and they don't exist in their own right. There were also people I'll talk about called the conceptualists who tried to bridge the gap in between them. And when in the Middle Ages, when these issues were really new and super critical, realists were people who believed in spiritual values entirely, and nominalists in non-spiritual values. That is a very different meaning, I think, from realism today. It was realism in those days which was so good or usable for theology, for early theology, including dogma on the Trinity and on the Eucharist. It was for the reason, this reason of quasi-nominalism in Aristotle that he was originally rejected by the church. Nominalism was considered the doctrine of skeptics and probably heretics. Conceptualism agreed with nominalism, but said there were some things like numbers which were not concrete, but really ideas in and of themselves. And having tried to teach mathematics or arithmetic to young people, to go from the idea of three as objects, apples, people, fingers, to the idea of three as a concept, which is independent of what three anything, is something that it takes children a long time to grasp. It was Abelard who first introduced conceptualism to try to mediate these two opposing camps, but it was too close to nominalism, and that's why it was rejected, particularly by St. Bernard. Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas were moderate realists, and that's why they were able to put Aristotle together with Christian theology. Nominalism came back with William of Ockham, and who had a complete distrust of abstraction and an impulse for only direct observation and inductive research. And this is Ockham's razor. And actually, the term Ockham's razor was not used by Ockham, but first appears in the English language in 1852. If you look up things in the Oxford English Dictionary, which is that long and one of the great works of human brains, it's easy to make that dictionary. You just have to read everything in the world that's ever been written, at least in English. And that's what people have done. And it always starts off when you look something up with what year it first appeared in the language. And so it's 1852 because I looked it up. He did not invent this idea because it appears from Aristotle to Maimonides in many writings, but he used it more than anybody else, and so his name got stuck to it. I've included the Latin partly so that to remind us that English is a Germanic language. Look at the words we get, entity, multiply, necessity, from our Latin ancestors. I also included it because I have a 13-year-old granddaughter who has found Latin to be her favorite subject at school, and that makes me very happy. The most radical attacks on Aristotelian science were made by two Franciscans in Oxford at the end of the 13th and the beginning of the 14th century. One is Ockham, but I want to start with the older one, who is John Duns Scotus, and he lived from 1266 to 1308. Now, during his lifetime, the Pope was John the 21st, and he was a very learned man, and he was interested in why Aristotle was becoming important, and he ordered an investigation into this conflict between Aristotle and the church dogma. But he never found out the results of the investigation, because as a very learned guy, he had a brand new library built in the Vatican, and it wasn't built to a very high standard, because while he was in there one afternoon reading, the ceiling fell down and killed him. Amongst the Aristotelian ideas that were condemned in this was the idea that the universe was infinite, which meant that there was no place for Genesis 1. In the beginning, there was light. Aquinas managed to marry Aristotle with Christianity, and that was fine. Now, Duns Scotus, however, denied the human mind any way of learning except through the senses. And again, when I mean senses, I mean testing things. I don't mean seeing things with your eye. For him, the answer to how to arrive at concepts independently of the senses lay in metaphysics. And in being was the most universal concept, and this contained all other possible concepts, all other categories, regardless of the different kinds of being. So it transcended the physical properties of any considerable being, and so it meant that metaphysics could then adduce the reality of God and the reality of human beings between God's existence as a necessary being and human beings as finite beings. We know how finite we are. And that was as far as one could go, meaning metaphysics could define that the being of God, but not the attributes of God, which meant particularly, and the Franciscans and the Dominicans didn't like each other very much, so it meant in particular that Aquinas' proofs of the existence of God were rubbish. The significance of Duns Scotus is that he broke away from previous methods of establishing natural theology, and he limited discourse about the divine and gave new force to nature and to creation. He separated existence and reason from revelation, from revealed truth, and from the sorts of determinism also that Aristotle had and which the church had originally condemned. He was a very great thinker. He has, however, left an extremely unfortunate impression on etymology, again, one of my favorite subjects. His followers were called Duns Men, that is, people who read and commented on the works of John Duns Scotus. Over the next couple of centuries, this came to mean a bookish pedant who read a lot and didn't understand very much of what they read, and has come down to our time to mean somebody who is completely ignorant, hence a dunce. It's a great misfortune, I think, a really very sad fate for an extremely learned gentleman. An unbridgeable gulf was opened between knowledge and faith, and an arrival at a new and better way of understanding and interpreting natural phenomena by this gentleman, William of Ockham. Ockham held that only certain knowledge was what he called intuitive knowledge, and this could only be gained by perception of individual things through the senses, that is, experimental testing of things. Everything else, all the reasons to explain these things were just theories. And he was the first person to distinguish between a hypothesis, which is an educated guess, and a theory, which is induced from observed phenomena. And so when people say, oh, the theory of evolution is just a theory, they are really trying to say, no, it's just a hypothesis, and that's not true. It's a very well-tested theory. Anyway, one of the major contributions of Occam was his, the understanding of the relationship between cause and effect. And this is something we almost take for granted today, but had to be introduced. And also he created the impossibility of absolute certainty in our theories of knowledge. And he said the following, that this is how you know what a cause is. When it's present, the effect follows, and when it's not present, all other conditions being the same, it doesn't follow. Okay? And again, quantum mechanics has changed this to some extent. It's changed it so that you don't, that it's not necessarily the cause, but there's a probability of a cause. For some other day. This form of nominalism, and this is nominalism, has come down to our own time and has even been cited in the right, just to skip quickly to the 19th century, it's been cited by John Stuart Mill, who wrote that the same effect may have many causes, so it's necessary to eliminate rival hypotheses. For a scientist, this is so basic and fundamental that it's shocking that it had to be invented, but it did. Occam destroyed most of the beliefs in which the 13th century had created physics. His appeal to his ideas, it was his ideas that led to his great controversy with the Avignon-based Pope John the 22nd, and he wrote the following. Our faith is not formed by the wisdom of the Pope. Shocking. For no one is bound to believe the Pope in matters which are of faith unless he can demonstrate the reasonableness of what he says by the rule of faith. That got him excommunicated. Now, I want to read you another quote which comes from one of the books I've been reading. From Augustine to Aquinas, philosophy had passed from consideration of truth as a reflection of God to truth in the relation of things to each other and to man, that is, cause and effect, leaving the relation for God to theology. Occam firmly divorced theology from natural philosophy, the former deriving its knowledge from revelation, and the latter from sensory experience, from which it alone took its origin. For these people, natural philosophy could order a probable but not a certain cause of explanations. But, and it's a huge but, which is not true for present-day scientists, where natural philosophy contradicted the necessarily correct propositions of revelation, philosophy was wrong and revelation was right. But after this time, and about, say, 1350 or so, and the deaths of these two men, John and William, no real further efforts were made to synthesize faith and reason. The strongest attacks on Aristotle's physics were made in the 14th century, and they centered on his ideas of matter, space, and time. Aristotle, as I think I've said innumerable times, did not believe in the existence of a vacuum. A vacuum could not exist because when an object went through the air, it needed a push, and it was the air that pushed it. So you had to have air. If you had to have air, there could be no void, there could be no atoms, because between atoms there would be nothing. But after 1277, theologists said, no, no, this can't be true. There could be a vacuum because you must not put any limits on what God could do if he had wanted to. So they said, well, suppose God had really wanted to create a vacuum, how would that work and what would happen? Among the topics that this kind of thinking brought up were the idea of lots of world, of infinities, of the acceleration, the beginning of the word, use of the word acceleration, of the flights of projectiles, the possibility of motion of the earth, etc., etc. And these speculations removed the barriers that Aristotle had brought that and made mathematics and speak to physics, which Aristotle had tried to maintain as two separate things. All of Aristotle's ideas about motion were questioned and challenged. He said that motion required a motive force, and I cannot resist putting in an equation. So here is an equation. The speed, now, in most equations, in over here, you would have two little horizontal lines, and they would stand for the words is equal to. So two little horizontal lines are better than three words. However, this is the Greek letter alpha, and it stands for three words also. It means is proportional to, or does depend upon. So the speed of an object, the velocity of an object, depends on how hard you push it. And it depends inversely on the resistance. So the bigger the friction or resistance, the slower it will go. It's an easy formula. However, what it says, if there's no resistance, then the velocity would be infinite, and that's impossible to Aristotle. It's also impossible anyway. Now, Aristotle, of course, had this teleological view of the universe, that is, the idea that objects, earth, air, fire, water, had their natural place. And so earth and water went down, and fire and air went up, because that was their homes. These ideas had begun to be criticized already back in the 6th century by the philosophers Philoponus and Simplicius. But it was really in the 14th century that disagreements became common. And Galileo, when he was a student at Padua in the 16th century, was taught this sort of thing. But it did not take him long, of course, to show that it was not true. Occam stated the following. After the, you know, when I said in a projectile, you push it and then it flies, okay, by itself. And Aristotle said, no, it pushes the air out in front, makes little whirlpools, they come around to behind and they keep pushing it. Absolute nonsense, but he's struggling for a reason. After the separation, the thing moved is according to itself and not by any power. Boy, that is really close to Newton's idea of inertia. This is in 1400 about, yeah, no, 1300 and something about, and it wasn't until 1680 that Newton came up with a better idea, with the correct idea. The neglecting of this, which I will talk a little bit about, is why physics comes from the 17th century and not the 14th century. Another theory that came very close to Newton's ideas of inertia was followed and created by the Frenchman Jean Bourdon, and he died about 1358, and he had created the theory of impetus. And he may also have got that from Philoponus back in the 6th century, we don't know. But he said, for a projectile, the motive power was impressed upon this projectile by itself, and this gave it an impetus, and this impetus would continue forever. That's what Newton says in terms of inertia. If it were not for some restraining force, which for a projectile in this case is the resistance of the air and gravity, which pulls it down to the ground. For Bourdon, a force was something which changed motion rather than caused it, and this is an idea that Newton grabbed onto with his second law, F equals ma. His idea of impetus is very close to what we would call today in physics momentum, which is the product of the mass and the velocity of an object. Where he made a mistake is he said that impetus, the continued motion of an object, would be the same in a straight line and in a circle. But Newton tells us that it's true in a straight line, but that in a circle the direction is changing and a force is required to change direction as well as to change speed. That's why we talk about velocity rather than speed, because in physics velocity is a different word from speed. It means how fast and in what direction. Two things. Okay. Again, you just don't know what happens to people's reputation with time, because poor Jean Buridan is not remembered for impetus in common language, but he's remembered for a satire of his theory of moral determinism. And this paradox has existed from the time of Aristotle, but it's given his name. It's called Buridan's ass. And so there's an ass which is hungry and thirsty, and it's placed in between a bale of hay and a bucket of water, but it doesn't know which way to go first, so it dies of hunger and thirst. Okay. Again, a nasty fate for a very clever gentleman. One of his students was a man named Nicolas Oresma, another French priest. By the way, Buridan, although a cleric, and everybody was a cleric, was a very independent cleric, and he refused to join either the Dominicans or the Franciscans or join a monastery or whatever. But everybody who taught at university universally was a cleric. They talked generally in the on the outdoors somewhere. They carried their chair around and they sat their chair down. And I found out several years ago that the hoods that academics wear at fancy parties and things, graduations, were made for money. That is, after they gave a lecture and their students were there, they would turn their back and the students would put money in there to pay them, and so they couldn't see who the student was. That's why it's wonderful. I love these little arcane facts. Anyway, Buridan used the idea of impetus and made it a really popular one. He likened the heavens of the motion, the motions of the heavens, to the workings of a clock. He also, by the way, wrote in not always in Latin, but he used medieval French. And so in many cases, the French, who are desperately proud of their language, consider him the creator or one of the originators of modern French prose. For celestial motions, he taught that there was impetus in the heavens and that this was due to the lack of any resisting force, so that they were given for some reason an initial push and they moved forever, so there was clearly a vacuum out there. He saw no reason that the earth could not be rotating, and gravity for him was not the attraction of objects, the teleological idea of Aristotle that the earth was the center and the home for this, but rather it was the attraction of any spherical mass of an object near its surface to the center, which is much more true. He also postulated, again contrary to Aristotle, that an object could have two motions or more at the same time. Aristotle said one motion at one time, it could go this way, it could go that way, but it couldn't go that way. He said there was no objection. He defined what we call relative motion. He said, look, I can't tell when I look at the sky whether it is the sun rising in the east and moving to the west, or whether it is the earth rotating from the west to the east. All I can see is that there is motion, and it's relative motion. It's not absolute motion. This is quite remarkable, and he got rid of many of the arguments that people had against the rotation of the earth, such as there would be this huge wind, because if the earth were rotating in this direction, the wind would be blowing like hell in that direction, and birds couldn't fly. He said, look, it's easy. The air is rotating along with the earth, which of course it is. And he said, if I have an arrow, an object on the surface of the earth can have more than one motion, if I shoot an arrow straight up, it's already rotating with the earth, and when it goes straight up, it's got that rotational motion, and it maintains it, and it falls straight back down. And all of this is correct. In the 14th century, we began to understand that the speed of objects could change, that is, could increase or decrease in relationship to the change of time. And uniform motion, which is a term that physics students hate, uniform motion means that an object could move equal distances in equal units of time. And these, again, were revolutionary changes at the time. Moreover, algebraic ideas began to be combined with geometrical ones, and Erasmus started making graphs in which he would put the speed of an object on the vertical axis and the time as it passed on the horizontal axis. So we began to understand that there was such a thing as acceleration, which was the change of speed as time passed. And this was particularly done in Merton College, Oxford, by such people as Thomas Bradwardine, William of Heytesbury, Richard of Wallingford, John of Dumbleton, and the one with my favorite name, Richard Swineshead. I can imagine where his father got that surname from. Anyway, there is a drawing of one of the Merton calculators that was made back from the Middle Ages, and he's calculating there the size of some object. Now, they showed a remarkable thing, and I can't resist, since I've showed you an equation, I'm going to show you a graph. And I copied this graph from Galileo's book written in 1638. But this was made by Richard Swineshead in 13-something or other. And it is a graph here of the speed of an object, and here is the time taken. And here is an object, this straight line represents an object which is changing speed. It starts from rest, and it goes faster and faster. It is doing what we call accelerating. And if he had known calculus, he would tell you that the slope of that line, the tilt of that line, is called the acceleration. This is velocity here, this is time here, and this slope of this line is the change of the speed divided by the change of the time, and that's called a derivative. So now you know some calculus. And so to go this way is not to go very fast, and that's a Ferrari or something. And what they demonstrated with this, is here we have a second motion, and this is a motion at constant speed, namely no acceleration at all, but the area under these curves, which is called an integral in calculus, is equal to the distance traveled. So this graph has three pieces of information. It contains the speed at any time, it contains the acceleration, and it contains the distance that it goes. And what was said is that if I take the mean speed, the halfway point between the beginning and the end, and I draw that line, and I measure the area under that, which is the distance traveled, it will be the same as the area of that triangle. So this is a fantastic accomplishment, and Galileo, who is a gentleman despite a bit of acerbic nature, said, look, I write this down, but I copied it from Erasmus. But he was taught this kind of thing also at Padua. In a different field, significant work was being done in the 15th century in astronomy by people such as George Purbach from 1423. We're now in the 15th century. And Regiomontanus, whose real name was Johannes Müller, who lived in the middle of the 15th century. And what they did was to modernize the Alphonsine tables, which had been written for King Alfonso of Spain, of Aragon, back in the 12th century, and contained information about the motions of the planets and the stars and eclipses and so forth, and was generally wrong. And certainly wrong as time went along. So those two men, Purbach and Regiomontanus, helped change the Alphonsine tables, which by the 15th century were inaccurate. And And Regiomontanus, in addition, wrote a textbook on trigonometry, which he basically copied from the 13th century mathematician Levi ben Gershon. Regiomontanus and his student were the first people to use a mechanical weight-driven clock to measure things, astronomical motions in the heavens. okay. Most scholars will agree that at the end of the 15th century, with the beginning of the Renaissance, marked a huge hiatus in the development of science. There was a diversion from considerations of matter to considerations of literary style, and a return to classical antiquity. And they ridiculed their medieval predecessors. I mentioned that on Monday, partly because they thought their medieval Latin was a joke compared to the beautiful Latin of Cicero and Ovid and so forth. And so it was from those people who created the canard that medieval scholasticism consisted of thinking about angels dancing on the heads of pins. This literary movement, however, did help the advance of science. Some people, such as one of the books I put on the reading list, God's Philosophers by James Hannam, have such a thing about the Renaissance. They are so angry at these men that they think no good whatsoever came from them in terms of science. And that's not true. We need to have a more reasonable perspective, because they translated innumerable old texts that had been previously only in Greek, works of Apollonius and Diophantus, and especially of that giant Archimedes. Once people had access to the great works of antiquity, they could quickly develop into the mathematical physics of Descartes and Galileo, and eventually into the development of the calculus by Newton. They also, and I don't have time to talk about, but they also created huge increases in the knowledge of biology and medicine, something I hope maybe to be able to talk about. Now, from this book by Alistair Crombie, which was not available in South Africa, and I've learned so much, I've taken some points. And I wanted to write them down. This is what we get from the scholastics: rational explanation of the use of mathematics. Somehow when I translate from Mac to PC, it loses the numbers, but that's a two. The extension of mathematics from restriction of Aristotle to all of physical science, and three, a radically new approach to space, time, and motion, impetus, the existence or possibility of existence of a vacuum. And he's got three more, which are technological advances, the mechanical clock, which I will talk about a bit tomorrow, the astrolabe, the quadrant, eyeglasses, wonderful invention, chemical balance, wind and water power, these things, medical things, the symptoms of disease and natural phenomena, and finally, the idea that what science is to do is to help, it's to be utilitarian, if you like, to help improve the lives of mankind, and the idea that you could never prove an absolute, that you could always have some new experiment which would contradict your present beliefs. The interest in technology, which has brought these thinkers into contact with artisans, and these artisans were able to create better instruments, and better instruments led to technological ability to do better experiments. And so the symbiosis between engineering and science grew from that. one of the very few Renaissance thinkers to actually use some of this information is, of course, Leonardo da Vinci, who based a lot of his ideas, his experiments and observations, first on Archimedes' use of levers, that is, give me a place to put my lever and I shall move the world, and of hydrostatics, where he ran naked out of his bathtub shouting Eureka, which means I found it in Greek. That was a theory, not something on his body. I didn't mean to do that. Da Vinci used the theory of impetus to describe projectile motion as well, and he used Greek geometry to improve lenses, but he had some errors. Now, there were great improvements of mathematics. There was a man named Tartaglia, his real name was Niccolo Fontana of Brescia, and he was the first person to solve cubic equations, that is, equations would have x to the third power in them. And however, in those wonderfully nasty days, another man, much more famous, named Jerome Cardano, stole that work and published first, so he's got credit for it and not... Fontana. Cardano's very famous because he was a compulsive gambler and he spent a lot of time and money on gambling, but to win, he invented probability, and he won a lot by understanding the laws of probability, and he was the only one because he invented it. It was a pupil of Cardano's with the famous name of Ludovico Ferrari, he was a fast guy, first solved a quartic equation, those involved x to the fourth power, and then we had to go a long time, 1823, Niels Abel, the Norwegian mathematician, showed that there were no formulas for any equation higher than the fourth power, that is x to the fifth, can only do by approximation on computer. So by the late 16th century, a man named Albert Girard introduced imaginary numbers, the square root of minus one, which has puzzled math students since that time. And from the 15th to the 17th century, we have the development of all of these symbols, the square root of minus one, plus, minus, equals, greater than, less than, and square root. All of these came into being at that time. Descartes is credited with combining algebra and geometry to form the subject called analytic geometry, but he based much of his work on Aresma, and he had a lot of help from his contemporary Pierre Fermat. But what this is the ability to describe geometrical curves, particularly conic sections. Conic sections are circles, ellipses, hyperbole, parabolas, etc., by algebraic equations. It's an immensely important thing. And this great invention then was quickly taken advantage of by Newton and then by Leibniz to invent the calculus. For Aristotle, mathematics could not express the essential nature of physical objects and processes, and he separated these two, and it was the scholastics who first began marrying these two disciplines. And I just wanted to mention a man who lived in the 16th century named Simon Stevin, or Stevinius in his Latin name, because he did the experiment for the first recorded time that is attributed to Galileo. After all, if there were to be a vacuum and you believe in teleology, that is, objects seek their own home, and the more mass there is in an object, the more eager or keen it is to get home, so that a heavy object falls faster than a light object in a vacuum. That's where that idea comes from, Aristotelian teleology. And so Stevin dropped two lead balls of different, one 10 times heavier than the other, onto a board. And of course, that way he could hear the sound when they hit, and of course they hit at the same time. In fact, they don't hit really at exactly the same time, because there's a little tiny bit of air resistance, and so, but it's, that's what physics does, is it ignores this kind of nonsense, so that we can understand what's really going on underneath. Galileo himself did a lot of work on ballistics, but he's most famous for his work on mechanics, which I showed you, from which I showed you the graph before, even though his much less important work on cosmology is what got him condemned by the Inquisition. And he accepted the basis of Platonic philosophy, that there were, that what he was doing was discovering the real intelligible structure in objective nature. And he did this again largely by, just as I said, abstracting the essential elements and ignoring the detail, like thinking about motion in a straight line and ignoring air resistance. Okay, so we didn't have to worry about those little things. In the 13th century, Ptolemy's cosmology was discovered and translated. And it was, at the time, only a means of calculating the positions of objects. It had no claim to actually saying this is how it works. All these circles upon circles, these cycles and epicycles. Ptolemy and everybody who read him knew that this was just physical nonsense, but it did allow you to calculate where our planet would be, and that's all people cared about. One of the problems, and I mentioned the Alphonsine tables had codified much of his work, but one of the problems was the calculations of the calendar, specifically for the church, the date of Easter. And this kept coming up over and over and over again. And in 1475, the great astronomer Regiomontanus was brought to Rome to try to figure out corrections. It's due to this that eventually we have the Gregorian calendar, which was about 100 years later. Other people, Oresme, Cusanus, had also made physical models, but the real person, of course, who did this was Nicholas Copernicus. And he created what he thought of was a physical model. It could also calculate the positions, but quite honestly, it wasn't any better at calculating where things were than Ptolemy's model. Okay? So it didn't have any practical use. What it did was appeal again to this Platonic idea of simplicity in nature, that the physics of how things actually work has got to be as simple as possible. He is, of course, a prime example of someone who revolutionized science by looking at established facts in a brand new way. His fear of appearing ridiculous to the world meant that he wouldn't publish until his student and disciple, Reticus, urged him to do so, and he finally agreed to do so, but it wasn't published, and the book appeared, and he saw it apparently on the day he died. But his work was received with real skepticism and true ridicule, just as he feared. Martin Luther wrote, "The fool would overturn the whole science of astronomy." Well, we now know who the fool was in that case. Here is, of course, Copernicus's model. This is from his drawing. There's the sun. There is the moon orbiting the Earth. There is the Earth going around Mercury, Jupiter, Saturn, etc., Mars, Jupiter, and on. Now, there were problems with this, objections to this. The first was Aristotle's teleology, namely that the Earth had to be the center of the universe, because and the center of the Earth had to be the center of the universe, because that was the home of heavy objects, and that's where they went. Well, Copernicus said, that's crazy. Gravity is a phenomenon which is local to a particular body, as I mentioned before. And this argument had been made by Cusanus, so he found that there. The second objection is a very serious one, and that's the lack of stellar paradox. And I'll try to explain that. To the ancients and to people up until the time of Copernicus, the universe was small. The seventh heaven was not far from the earth. There were these things were on these crystal spheres nested one after the other. Now, parallax is if you look at an object by closing your left eye and your right eye, then you will see that they move as you close an eye and look at them. That's parallax. So if you look at an eye, at an object far away, like those pillars for me, and I look at the right side and I draw a line there, and then I look at the left side and I draw a line there, there will be an angle between those two lines. Now, and that's because that's close. When you look at the stars from Cape Town or New York, the stars are in the same, they're not the same stars, but if you can see the same stars, they're not in this, they're in exactly the same position. So there is no parallax. The angle is exactly the same. Now, even more troubling is if you look at the stars in January and then you look at the star again in June, so that the baseline now is several hundred million kilometers long, they still have the same angle. And Copernicus says, well, that's easy to fix. The stars are incredibly far away, as they are. So it is Copernicus who said that the universe is one heck of a lot bigger than any of us have ever thought. The third objection, of course, was Aristotle's insistence that an object could only have one motion at a time, but nobody believed that by that time. But there was a huge problem that people ignored for 250 years, and they knew it, and it stared them right in the face. And this leads me to my second equation. Namely, that if I have an object and I look at the right side and I look at the left side, then Greek geometry, Mr. Euclid, tells me that the diameter of this object is multiplied by the distance to it and the angle. And if we look at the stars in the sky, they have a physical size. They're not dots. They actually have a size. And so you can see this edge, and you can measure the diameter, and you can see that, and you can see the angular difference. Well, if this is as big as Mr. Copernicus tells it is, then these stars are gigantic. And that's a problem. Okay? And it stayed from 1543, when Copernicus wrote it down, to 1809, when Thomas Young explained it by saying, look, light is a wave, and when waves enter into the iris of our eye, they spread out, and they diffract, and they look bigger than they are. And it's our problem, not Copernicus's or the stars' problem. But 250 years over that, people believed in this heliocentric universe and had this big problem staring right at them. It's quite an interesting concept to me. Copernicus's work led, of course, to Tycho Brahe, to Kepler, to Galileo, and all the things that helped lead in from astronomy to the scientific revolution. Changes in physics and mathematics were matched by nearly equal changes in physiology and medicine. Galileo had analyzed the strength bearing of bones and had deduced that there was a limit to the size of animals that could be on the earth. That's why whales live in the sea and don't walk on the earth. They're too big and they would break. It was his work, passed on to his former colleagues at Padua, which led to the use of the clock to measure pulse rates and thermometers to measure fevers. The greatest work on anatomy was published by Vesalius, also in Padua, in 1543, exactly the year that Copernicus wrote his book. And it was his discussion of the heart as a muscle that led William Harvey to get this great breakthrough about blood circulation in the body. The idea that the septum of the heart has no holes in it for blood to go from the left side to the right side meant that it had to go down through arteries, come back through veins, go be processed in the pulmonary and through the pulmonary arteries and get oxygenated and come back. But this was not very well accepted until the invention of the microscope, and we could see capillaries in the body, which is the way that blood gets from arteries to veins. But a lot of this had actually already been hypothesized way back by this great Persian writer Avicenna, the real father of medicine. But the work of Descartes, of Harvey, and Galileo led to a mechanization of biology. The heart is a pump, the lung is bellows, the muscles as struts, etc., etc. And I want to read you one last quote. By the middle of the 17th century, European science had come a long way since Adelard of Bath had demanded explanations in terms of natural causes, and since the experimental and mathematical methods had begun to develop in the 13th and 14th centuries. Certainly, in experimental and mathematical techniques, revolutionary progress had been made by the 17th century, and this was to go on with breathtaking speed throughout that century. To take only one science as an example, astronomy in 1600 was Copernican, and not even completely so, but 100 years later, in 1700, it was Newtonian and supported by the incredible structure of Newtonian mechanics. The utilitarian idea of science, as emphasized by Francis Bacon at the beginning of the 17th century, was not so far away from the work of Roger Bacon in the 13th century. I'm going to skip all this. Oh, no, there's an important thing I need to tell you. There is this desire for a certain knowledge of nature. This not only inspired Bacon, but inspired all of the rational thought that happened in Europe, at least since the time of St. Augustine, and likely even since the time of Plato, and was behind all of 17th century science. Until the empirical theory thinking of John Locke at the end of the century, 17th century, scientists believed that beyond this observed world that they saw, they were discovering an intelligible system of the real world. This is very Platonic. The emphasis on mathematics and reality brings us back to the original Greek discussion of Aristotle and others on substance, on entities, on qualities, the classification into primary and secondary qualities, primary being shape, mass, things that I talked about as substance, still or at rest, one or many. Secondary qualities are color, smell, names we give like bitter or sweet, red or blue names. Descartes, for one, attempted to build his entire philosophy on distinguishing between a mathematical and an objective world and a mental subjective one. He made interaction between body and mind impossible. This Cartesian dualism was subject to great criticism and ridicule during the 60s and 70s of the last century. And even though I've run over a minute or two, I have to tell you a joke, because philosophy does not have many jokes, but there's a joke I love about Descartes. Descartes is famous for cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. I wouldn't be unless I thought. Descartes goes into a sandwich shop and he asks for a turkey on whole wheat sandwich, please. And the sandwich owner says, "I'm sorry, we don't have turkey, but we have chicken." and we don't have whole wheat, but we have white bread. And would chicken on white bread be okay? And Descartes looks at him and says, I don't think so, and he disappears. I really like that joke. there was this wonderful TV program in Britain called Boffins Telling Jokes. Boffins, of course, being British for smart people who aren't very practical, I guess. Let's go on, because I have just a little bit, and I have one more surprise for you. Leibniz tended to overcome this distinction by creating a theory called monads, which I will not go do any more about. Idealists, such as Hegel, this led to a division within philosophy. There was idealism on one side, Hegel as the best example, who had little to do with science, and yet they were French Enlightenment thinkers who began to think of human beings as a machine, such that thoughts were just secretions of the brain, the way bile was a secretion of the liver. John Locke had posited long before what we know are not the objects in an external world, but only the experiences that arise from our senses. Newton was able to describe how gravity worked, but not to understand what it was that gravity was doing. How could the sun reach out and touch the earth? He probably believed that there was such an explanation, but he couldn't understand what it was. It was left to David Hume, who is often described as the 18th century version of William of Ockham, to dispose of the notion of cause. He showed that empirical data do not carry explanations. They give you no ground for belief in causality. They just describe what happens. And here are his words. Every effect is distinct from its cause, and so it doesn't exist in its cause, and the first invention or conception of it a priori must be entirely arbitrary. And so I have an example. What is that? Now that's a drawing by René Magritte, who is a surrealist, and what he tells us is in French, no, this is not a pipe. And what he's trying to do, of course, as a surrealist, is confuse you. But in fact, he's right. It's not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe. It's a representation of a pipe. That's what we learn about physical reality. Not what's there, but a representation of it. And finally, and now I will come to an end, it was Immanuel Kant who wrote in the Critique of Pure Reason that the active role of a scientist lies in asking questions and in constructing theories to deduce phenomena from these. Science is today seen as a creative exercise, not as a dissection of nature. Experiments and theories are attempts to make sense of the world by demonstrating that observed facts can be deduced from a theory. Now, as a working scientist or as a former working scientist, I can tell you these metaphysical considerations do not ever enter into the laboratory or to the blackboard. But they're there, and we all know that science is such that there will never be absolute certainty. We can never get the end to know for sure that what we have. From the Averroists of the Middle Ages to the materialists of the 19th and early 20th centuries, the idea that science could discover real entities in nature led us to believe that a final discovery could be made and no further questions needed to be asked. This is best summed up by a quotation that's from the end of the 19th century that has no attribution that anybody has ever been found. So we don't know who said it, if anybody ever said it, but it is attributed to that great scientist, Lord Kelvin. And it goes, all that is left in physics is the addition of more decimal places to known numbers. This occurred just before the discovery of the theories of relativity and quantum mechanics, which are probably the most revolutionary things ever to happen in the history of science, and the death of determinism, the death of the relationship between cause and effect, and the understanding that for every cause there is a series of probable effects, so that I could easily walk through that door rather than opening it, except that the probability of that happening is I'd get a bump on my head instead of passing through the door. And if I did pass through the door, my left arm would go, right arm would go that way, and my head would go that way, and I would stop being. Anyway, that's enough for today. I've only run 5 minutes over. Thank you very much.